You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 54. The last show was all about the founding of New Orleans. Throughout 2018, the city of New Orleans will be celebrating our tricentennial, so I thought a discussion about the founding of the city would be a great way to end 2017. Author Richard Campanella joined me as we discussed his book, Bienville's Dilemma. Or more precisely, we used his writing as a guide to the conditions and decisions that led France to place the city of New Orleans where it sits today. Learn all about the city as it was back in 1718 and even before. You'll also discover how you can see traces of the early boundaries even today if you know where and what to look for. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. Richard is a geographer and a historian, and his unique approach to history helps me see the city in new ways each time we talk. And this was no exception. I enjoyed the discussion, and I think you will too. Today's episode is sponsored by me. As you know, the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast is all about helping you explore New Orleans like an insider. If you're planning a trip to New Orleans and you want to cut through all the research, we're here to help you. We offer a personalized travel consult. Here's how it works. First, you complete a brief questionnaire to help us get to know you and the experience you want to have in New Orleans. This includes things like your interests, your budget, and the dates of your visit. Next, we set up a 20 to 30 minute phone call. During the call, we get to know each other a little better, and it helps me clarify any questions and bounce a few ideas off of you to make sure we're on the right track. Finally, I prepare and deliver a document to you with recommendations for your trip. Depending on your needs, the report will contain specific places to stay, eat, and drink. I'll also offer suggestions on things to do and see, again, all based on your budget and interests. Sounds good? Just go over to www.beyondbourbonst.com/travel for all the details and a link to order the service. Now, let's jump into the discussion. Today's show is going to be the first of a mini-series we're doing about plantations. I'm frequently asked about visiting Louisiana plantations, so my wife and I decided to take a couple days and explore on our own, on your behalf. Now, might be a good time to mention, if you have young children listening in with you, you might want to skip this one for now. The subject of today's episode may be a bit intense, especially for kids younger than, say, middle school age. Anyway, as my wife and I discussed how to approach the trip, two things kept coming up. One, the grandeur of the plantation homes themselves, against the reality that they were built on the backs of enslaved people. I know people are interested in the logistics of visiting the plantations, as well as what you might expect and where you should go. And we're going to cover all that stuff in a future episode. However, I kept coming back to the enslaved and what it meant to visit the plantations. Is it okay to go see the grand homes? And what did I really know about the enslaved people? We ultimately decided to approach our visit to River Road by first tackling the subject of slavery. To do this, we started at Whitney Plantation. As you'll hear, Whitney's current owner has decided to make the enslaved the primary focus of their tours, their exhibits, and the research they do. And so this made it a logical starting point for us. It also happens to be near the beginning of the path you would take from New Orleans to travel up River Road. Logistically, we visited the Whitney on the first morning of our 3-day trip. We then continued on to Nottoway Plantation, which is one of the largest and the most opulent. Again, you'll hear all the details about our trip on a future episode. On today's show, you're going to learn about the people who were kidnapped, sold, and came to work at the Whitney and other plantations along River Road. You'll meet some of them, and you'll hear their surprising connections to modern-day New Orleanians. You'll gain some insight into the conditions they endured and what plantation life was like for the enslaved, as well as the owners of the plantation. Most plantations along River Road were sugar plantations, so you'll also learn about the process of making granulated sugar on a plantation. All right, I think that's enough of an introduction. To help me dive into this history, I sat down with Joy Banner at the Whitney. Joy is the director of marketing and is a descendant of some of the slaves who worked there. With that, let's dive into our discussion. Thank you so much, Joy, for joining me today.
My pleasure in being here.
I'm joined by Joy Hunter, and we're here at the Whitney Plantation along River Road. And I asked to come and meet with you today because I really wanted to share with the listeners maybe a perspective that they don't have about plantations. And we're going to do an overview about visiting plantation country here in Louisiana. And of course, I believe, and I know that you believe, that it really starts with understanding the perspective of the enslaved. So if we could, Joy, talk a little bit about how did your journey come to the Whitney Plantation?
Well, actually, I am a resident of this area. I grew up about a half a mile away from Whitney Plantation. And at the time Whitney opened in 2014, we've only been open for touring for the past 3 years, I was a professor in Austin, Texas. And my sister is part of the River Parish's Tourist Commission. So she represents all the plantations and different attractions in a tri-parish region. And so when Whitney came online, she had spoken to John Cummings and was familiar with Whitney and its mission. And so when I wanted to move back home to Louisiana, and I was very interested in Whitney, and when a job became available, I decided that I was very much interested in working here, and the rest is history.
Well, and we talked about just a diversion. You have a twin sister, Jo, and obviously the longtime listeners know that I have twin daughters as well. So, but let's talk about just for a moment. Let's orient people where we are. Where is the Whitney relative to New Orleans and the river?
So Whitney is in a small town called Wallace. Most people are familiar, a little bit more familiar with Edgard. But we are about 40 miles west of New Orleans going towards Baton Rouge. So we're actually in the middle of New Orleans and Baton Rouge. We are considered part of the greater New Orleans metropolitan area. So you'll hear this area referred to as New Orleans plantation country because right. There is a concentration of about 8 or 9 plantations on both sides of the river between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And we have this huge map at Whitney, an old map that was from the 1800s, and that at the time shows you all the different plantations from New Orleans all the way down to Baton Rouge, and is literally hundreds of plantations. This was a very, very wealthy area, and originally it was settled to provide food and provide goods to the people that were settled in New Orleans. So its location was very advantageous for people that wanted to come here and settle, and is obviously very profitable because we're along the river, and so you could take the products and put them right onto the river from these locations along the River Road.
Sure. And as longtime listeners know, well, in fact, in a recent episode, episode 53 with author Richard Campanella, we were talking about the founding of New Orleans, but talking about how riverfront land, when lands were granted, it was obviously important for plantation owners to have a slice of land yes. right on the river so that they could trade goods and sell goods and get them down the river.
Yes. Yes. And we still have these teeny tiny slices of land. My neighborhood that I grew up in, we have like tracts of land that are very, very narrow at the front, but they go way back into the swamps. In fact, right. We still own property way back into the swamps, and we use that land to lease out to sugarcane companies today because that's really all you can do with it. You can't sure. even, some of them are not really wide enough to even put a true house on it. So it's very interesting when you look at the topography. If you can get hold of a map and look at how the acreage is laid out, you can see how this was all developed for that sugarcane trade.
Right. And again, we talked about in the earlier episode with Richard, the French unit of measurement, the arpent, and how there would be a couple of arpents granted, arpents about 192 feet, a couple of arpents granted to each plantation or landowner right up against the river. But as you describe, then it would go back in a slice, almost like the blade of an old-time lady's fan that you might hold, right?
Right.
A triangle that gets wider, but pretty narrow slices that go way back. And again, the land is really fertile, but you need a way to get goods to market. And that was
right.
Your riverfront was your main street, if
right,
you will.
Right. It was a very, very busy highway,
right.
so to speak.
So again, we're about 40 miles upriver from New Orleans. And that's important in the context both of why the plantations were here, but also as you're listening and thinking about a visit to this area, The Whitney and some of the others right near here are well within an easy drive. And we're going to talk about that probably in a separate episode in terms of visiting. But again, what drew my interest to you guys and to the Whitney specifically was that you have taken sort of a unique mission among the many plantations here in Louisiana about your emphasis. And if we could start maybe a little bit with the present owner and how he came to own it and his thoughts about that mission.
Yes. Well, John Cummings is an attorney from New Orleans, and he purchased this property in 1999. And as he tells it, he just thought that I am Southern guy. It's just a Southern thing to do to own a plantation, right?
A Southern white guy, we should point out.
Southern white guy. So it was, you know, I don't want to say a status symbol, but he owns a lot of real estate. And I think as far as a real estate endeavor, this was attractive to him in that sense. It was through his research, though, when he dug deeper, and I give him credit, you know, mm-hmm. for doing that research and really examining like the slave narratives. And he understood and started getting more details about the brutality of slavery. He realized that this couldn't be a plantation just like any other plantation. There was a lot of the story that he himself felt he did not know. And, you know, his famous statement he uses a lot is, we ask African Americans to get over it, but we don't really understand what the it is. And so as a country, he thought that we needed to spend more time focusing on what the it is. And Whitney Plantation was designed to educate people on more of the specifics and the details of slavery, and also the culture, the economic system, everything that came into play when we're dealing with a slave economy.
When we first started exploring this, and then my wife and I had the opportunity to visit with you the other day, it becomes, as you dig beyond the base level and the grand homes that you think of, or that many people think of when they think of plantations, it quickly gets to economics, right?
Absolutely.
And so much, we're going to talk about things that are really harsh, but of course it boils down to economics.
Right.
And you pointed out when we were here the other day that from the very beginning, it was always about economics. And that is one of the things that really struck me about the harshness, that slaves were a commodity. They were chattel.
They were chattel.
And so to that end, it was one of many ingredients, one of many supplies
right.
that
it
a landowner
just,
needed.
It was, I don't know if it was even considered, I want to say necessary evil, but I don't know how evil it would have been considered. I think it was just necessary. And, you know, in developing the country, in developing the area, you needed oxen, you needed, you know, equipment, and you needed slaves. And we see all of those elements, you know, in various documentation where it's all part of one supply list, you know, like you're going to the grocery stores, you need, you know, flour, you need, you know, supplies, and you need a few slaves along the way. I mean, it was treated, and I'm not saying it to mock, but I'm just saying it was treated with that level of casualness. And yeah, I mean, and it was all for the improvement, for the creation of a developed a country. So this was the United States that we're living in now. That was all in the plans, and that was all designed to get us here. And the essentialness of slaves, of the enslaved people and of slavery was something that was known from the beginning, and the hopes for where we are now, I think, was definitely something that was intentional.
Again, back in episode 53 with Richard Campanella, Richard wrote a book called Bienville's Dilemma, and it's about Bienville, along with the French government, deciding where to place the city we now know as New Orleans. And in very early accounts, months after the first people settled, there were notes about, we need these supplies, including slaves. There was no including. It was just, right. We need this, we need this, we need this. And one of the things that strikes me, when you come into the grounds of the Whitney and you go in the sort of front room, the start of the museum, if you will, there's a very poignant example and exhibit about, here's a mortgage that was taken out.
Yes.
Paid, you know, either paid for in slaves or secured by slaves.
Right.
And you could mortgage, you could take out a mortgage to purchase other people.
Yes.
To purchase slaves.
Yes. And like I told you before, I was a business professor for 8 years. And for all of the guides and all of the staff working at Whitney, there are certain elements of slavery that resonate the most with us or affects us the most. And for me, the economics and the business and the documentation and the records associated with doing business, except it refers to people, are the things that just gives me the creeps. It creeps me out the most. And to see those mortgage documents and to see title searches, that documentation that a person has come back with a clear title, allowing you to sell that person. And in one case, it's a woman and her children. You know, so it's those types of things that really affect me and stay with me long after I've finished giving a tour or after I've finished talking about it. You know, it just... is something that is so unbelievable. You know, it really is hard to process it sometimes, but you know, we have the documentation. We have the original documentation that proves that this did indeed happen.
Well, and for me, it was very powerful. Again, I think those of you that have listened know I'm a white guy, I'm a Caucasian man, and sort of so much about the podcast over the last couple of years, race comes back so much, and the differences between people, and more importantly than the differences, the way that we treat people.
Right.
So much of New Orleans, you just can't get away from that. And for me, like you, I have a finance background. I'm walking in and seeing this sort of dehumanization, in an odd way, makes it humanizing to
right.
me, because you think, wait a minute, I'm a person, and here we are talking about title searches
yes.
on you or
yes.
me. Is the right? Is the search clean? Is the ownership chain
right.
of ownership clean?
Right.
And I think it's presented very factually, but it's gut-wrenching to see it. Again, like any kind of property, and you can see it here, you can see it at other places as well. The Historic New Orleans Collection comes to mind in the city with the records there, but you can see there's a difference in prices if
right.
you're young, if you're considered mm-hmm. Able-bodied, strong-backed,
right.
versus if you are older than the median age back then, or you have some sort of infirmary, then the value
down.
You convey or that can be paid is different.
Yes.
And I think from the moment you walk in, for one thing, if you come to the Whitney and you take a tour, I don't want to give it all away because I do think you should come, but you are presented with a lanyard and a picture. But that tells the story of a young child, an enslaved child,
right.
On the back of the story. And you see a picture in the front. And it's a really powerful way, I think, of trying to, this idea you and I spoke about of radical empathy.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to say, let me try to walk in your shoes. And it's another to say, let us try to walk in each other's shoes from the perspective of that person.
Yes. Well, and what you're pointing out is it's actually John Cummings, the founder, he is a big proponent of education and has a really soft heart when it comes to children. And one of the things that he wanted to do, he felt that this was a way that people would be able to empathize with this story of enslaved people. Because we know slavery, obviously, it's a black and white issue, because as a black person, you had certain rights or lack thereof. Which it was determined by your skin tone. But there's so much of it is not about black or white. You know, it's about a system. And to get people of any color, of any nationality, to be able to understand that this is about humanity, this is about the treatment of, you know, of people who treated as commodity, and these were humans. The way that he felt that people would be able to understand and embrace the story is from the perspective of children, you know, and I think it has been effective, because they're the most innocent. They're the ones
sure.
that we're supposed to protect. And as a mother, and that's what, I don't have any children, but I tell you, it is those stories where it's a mom and two or three children, and you see a price for a group of people, you know, that mom and her kids, that to me is, that's the stories. Those are the stories that get to me the most.
Yeah,
it really makes it personal.
It
just connects you to them.
And it does. I think that on the one hand, small thing, you're given a lanyard and a card. It's not a small thing when you look at it and you really think about it. So now I do want to talk a little bit about the Whitney. When was the Whitney created? Obviously, John Cummings bought it in modern times, but when was it created? I'd like to talk just a little bit about the original owners and then get into sort of the two separate sources, if you will, of slaves.
Okay.
But let's talk a bit about the original owners and the founding of the plantation.
Okay. So this was originally Habitation Heidel. So Ambrose Heidel came over from Germany, and Whitney Plantation was started in 1752 and was in operation as a sugarcane plantation up until the 1970s. But he originally came over as an indentured servant. And he was contracted, I guess, for lack of a better word, by a company that went bankrupt before he came here. So he was supposed to serve 3 years in indentured servitude that never materialized. And so then he found himself in a position of having to make his own means. And so he originally started on the other side of the river, on the East Bank, and then came over in 1752. They had a subsistence farm and then transitioned over into indigo. And by the late 1790s, when the sugar processing technology became more available, that's when they switched over to making sugar. And of course, that was their real, indigo was the first cash crop, but sugar cane, there's a reason why it's called white gold. So that is where the profit came from. And the Hydells were some of the wealthiest people along the river. So they came here basically having nothing. And within a rather short period of time, they were able to own enslaved people and become wealthy people along the river.
And I think maybe a lot of people don't know that there is a large German population. There was a large German influx, and we're not that far from La Place.
Right.
And all up and down the river coast here, they're known for andouille sausages, right, and things that...
And bonfires, which is a German tradition. But yeah, this is known as the German coast.
Yeah.
So St. Charles and St. John Parish is part of the German coast. And you'll see a lot of German surnames that may have French translations or, right, you know, French pronunciations, but they're actually like Heidel, really is Heidel. You know, that's the way it's pronounced in Germany, but you'll see a lot of changes in the name to make them seem more French.
Well, and today, this is probably a topic for another day, but if you're wondering, particularly if you're from New Orleans, if that sounds vaguely familiar, it's because the anglicized version of that today is Heidel's.
Heidel's.
So most people in New Orleans are very familiar with Heidel's Bakery,
right,
and King Cakes and all that. But so he comes, he sort of has a remarkable story that he goes from coming as an indentured servant to becoming a wealthy landowner and businessman in his own right. But he comes and now he needs slaves of his own.
Yes.
And one of the things that's pretty powerful behind the main house here is that wall that has two sides to it and talks about slaves from a certain period and then slaves from a different period. And I'd like to kind of explain that a little bit in terms of how were slaves procured, if you mm-hmm. will, and how did that change over time as the laws changed?
Yes. Well, the wall that you're referring to is the Wall of Honor. So it lists the names of the people that were enslaved at Whitney Plantation. It's probably not a complete list, as we talked about before. Finding all of the records from that long, for hundreds of years, it's not very easy. But we do have about 350 names on the wall. And one side represents the transatlantic slave trade. And this is the period before 1807, when it was still legal to import people from Africa into the United States. And because West Africa was settled by French colonies, and also we have, you know, French colonists here in Louisiana, sure, there was this natural supply link of Africans from West Africa to Louisiana. So we have a lot of the majority are from the Senegambia region. But yeah, so at that point, they were allowed to be transported in the transatlantic slave trade. And when Thomas Jefferson banned the transatlantic in 1807, it was with allegedly the intention of the slave trade eventually phasing out.
Sure, you know, if your supply is cut off, eventually they'll die.
Right. Eventually it will die off, and conveniently he would be dead at that point. And so, you know, he would have his servants for the rest of his life and then let everyone else deal with, you know, doing things for their own. But in the United States, we simply switched over from the transatlantic to the domestic slave trade. And this is where we saw, you know, the United States really developed the slave trade into what we, the chattel slavery, into the big numbers, that big supply that we see today. But we had plantations that were set up on the eastern coast that were specifically for breeding people, you know, and they would be sold or bought and sold on the east coast. And initially they would be chained together and walked across land for thousands of miles. Many would die along the way, but that was okay for the slave trader because there were insurance policies to kind of take care of the ones that died off, right? And then later they were also transported onto ships and brought into New Orleans and then sold to the plantations along the river.
Which was, of course, the largest slave market in the South.
Yes.
And you guys have a depiction that I think is courtesy of the Historic New Orleans Collection.
Yes.
That is a map of the French Quarter and shows visually where the slave markets were.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, again, it jumps at you as it should and really brings it home. There were two things I wanted to kind of touch on that you just mentioned. One, another moment for me in this discovery and thinking about plantations and how I would share the story with my guests and my listeners is this idea of breeding plantations and breeding. I had never stopped to consider that until
yes.
we spoke the other day, and that there were places you think about and you hear stories of plantation owners would rape or sometimes take forcibly mistresses from the slave population.
Yes.
But there were places that saw this as we are going to impregnate. We're going to do this because we are creating more product.
Absolutely,
if
yes.
you will.
Absolutely. And in children that were of mixed race, particularly girls, and we have an exhibit, we have a panel in our exhibit that talks about that particularly attractive, lighter complected women, or young girls who had domestic skills, they were known as fancy girls, they could command a higher price. So they were basically being sold into sex slavery because of their beauty. And that was intentional by some of these owners. You created these mixed race children and then you could get a higher value. So in a lot of cases, it's not, I think in some of the depictions, you'll see the owners that have a sort of sense of responsibility or more of a sense of benevolence towards their own children. And that did happen in some cases. And then you had others that were like, okay, well, this is another baby that I can sell.
Sure.
So we see the range.
And I think that's something, again, at first glance, when people think about or visit plantations, you don't think about, but that
right.
really personalizes it. And again, it's that it makes it very human and dehumanizing
right.
at the same time. The other thing that you were sharing with us the other day when we talked about the transatlantic trade, and we tend sometimes naively or ignorantly to think about, well, African slaves.
Right.
But of course, just like if you picture the United States or you picture Europe, the United States is made up of many different people.
Right.
Africa is made up of many different
right.
people, different cultures, different dialects, different languages.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we were shopping, if you will.
Yes.
Planters were
Good
shopping
word.
Along the coast of Africa for what we needed. You mentioned the Senegambia region is really between two rivers, and that plain is an agricultural plain.
Right.
So we were shopping for people that were familiar, that lived in an agrarian society.
Very much so. And the climate of Louisiana is very similar to that region. So you know that you get people that are living along large bodies of water, that are accustomed to some swampy areas, that are accustomed to, you know, the different creatures and the wildlife and the humidity and the climate. And so you essentially went in and just selected what you needed to, in order for this area to develop the way that the colonists wanted to develop it.
And as horrible as all of that is, once again, as we were talking, you then made the point of not only has all of this happened, and this is an atrocity, but imagine now if 100 of us were grabbed randomly from wherever we are. We don't know each other. We don't speak the same language.
Right.
And now not only has this horrible thing happened to us, we are now about to have this shared experience.
Yes.
And instantly going to be expected to communicate
right.
and to produce for someone else.
Right. I mean, and it doesn't, what if you are sold to a plantation where the majority of the population might be from Senegal and you're from Ghana, you know, and everyone is speaking a shared language or a majority, and you're one of the minority within the minority, and what your existence is like as you're put into this new population. So it's definitely it speaks to the psychological and the sociological pressures that were in part of the enslaved community and their experience, and how difficult that would have been for them, but also the pressure of, if you don't produce in a certain way, then you are going to be punished for it in some way, or and brutally punished in a lot of cases, because of you not being able to necessarily blend in as sure. well with everyone as you're expected to.
Well, and it hit me that people all over the world don't get along. And right. so you all of this happens, and very likely some of those were probably natural enemies.
Right. right? Absolutely.
Their countries, their tribes, their, you know, wherever they're from. And now there's just all these dynamics. Again, the point is, it's easy, I think, it was easy for me to think about slavery in air mm-hmm. quotes, but it's so much more nuanced.
Oh, very
And nuanced. The more you dig into the nuances, it makes it even more horrible, mm-hmm. if that's possible, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Because it makes it personal again.
Right.
That you really dig in and you just think about your sort of people you get along with, people you don't, people you can communicate with, people you can't.
Right.
And now they're all captured, kidnapped, paid for, mm-hmm. and made to work in a foreign environment.
Right. And it was sometimes used by the owners, you know, you wanted solidarity because you wanted the work to get done, but then you also wanted a means of information. You also wanted that population to be controlled by someone other than you. And you know, it was a chain of command, and so there were certain things that you can do. Like, you could offer a better cabin to one person. You could offer, because there were financial incentives that were offered to enslaved people as well. If you were in charge of a work gang that went into the fields and you were head of that gang, you could get financial incentives for making the rest of the gang produce more. So again, you are complicating those relationships, and you are getting favor for someone that is in that class, but you're making them feel more favored and more upper class than everyone else, right? So you are turning people intentionally against each other. And I say that because I feel, and I had a journalist that asked this question, she couldn't understand why Africans sold other Africans into slavery, you know, and why were the Africans fighting each other? And of course, the Europeans fought each other for everyone. And no one says, well, because they all had white skin, they shouldn't have been fighting each other. But that is the implication when we talk about what was happening in Africa. Like, there should have been some solidarity.
Because they all share skin color.
Because of your skin color. And I think as a community, we still are expected to think the same way, to feel the same way. And don't get me wrong, I totally am for the need for us to be unified. But within that unity, we're going to have different perspectives. And it's a lot more dynamic than people want to give us credit for.
Right. Well, you know, the odd thing there is, you're talking, I'm thinking about the Civil War.
Absolutely.
And it was obviously fought for, people had different perspectives on it, but it was fought between often families, right? So same skin color, same right. upbringing in a lot of cases, differing of opinions mm-hmm. and strong enough to cause them to fight each other.
Right.
But right, it's an interesting perspective that yet sometimes if it's over there, wherever over there is, you tend to think of that group as homogenous.
Right.
And why would they be?
Right.
Again, it's one of the things, one of the reasons I wanted to do this episode, and one of the reasons I think the Whitney is so important, is that it causes you to be uncomfortable, but more importantly, to really think about why you think what you think.
Right.
And the narrative, whether it's in my own head or sort of just the general thing. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I wanted to talk about is, we're back to economics, of the economics and the sort of dynamics of running a plantation affected everything from the, you think about slave quarters and sort of a village, although that's probably not the best term, but there were dynamics there that were set up intentionally
right.
with an eye towards what's going to be in the best perspective of the economy of the right. plantation.
Right. And specifically, enslaved people were allowed to grow their own vegetables. And, you know, every plantation is different. So, sure. I mean, just keep in mind that when I say these things, it might not be true for every single
right.
plantation. And that's kind of the difficulty that we have sometimes, too, is that people want to make this universal for every single plantation experience. But even allowing enslaved people to grow their own crops, if you have someone that's on the plantation that's growing it, then that's less money as an owner that you have to spend on feeding, on providing rations for the other enslaved people. And that person is now growing for your family as well. So again, you know, you can't just go to the grocery store like you can now. I mean, that's a lot of, it's a lot more expensive back then to be able to grow and cultivate your own food. But now you have somebody that's on the plantation, you know, with his or her garden that can now add to your supply chain.
Right. Sure. And that's kind of a good segue into, we've talked about the primary crop fairly early on becomes sugarcane, or certainly by the late 1700s. And one of the things that struck me the other day as you and I were talking is, so, you know, you got this context of enslaved people, and then it's sort of generally sort of this double whammy that we think of as innovation and technology, mm-hmm. and the cotton gin is invented. Yes. And in the same sort of time period, Etienne de Boré figures out how to granulate sugar here along the Sugar right. Coast. And now thinking back, I got to imagine, so not only is it an absolutely horrendous thing that you've become enslaved, and now the incentive for slave, mm-hmm. for people to own slaves has shot through because the value right. has gone through the roof.
Right.
Right. We're in a place where you can grow both of those things pretty close by. Mm-hmm. Sugarcane right out the back door where we are, but cotton 50, 75 miles away. And now what do you need to do that? Because now it's even more efficient. You need labor.
You need the labor. You need the labor. So any advance in technology, like you said, anything that brought us closer to development, now you needed more people.
You could make more money if you only had more people, yep. because you could be more efficient.
The wealth along this river was massive. You know, these homes, there's a reason why they are, and they didn't start off this way. So if you look at an older plantation home from the late 1700s or maybe mid 1700s, they are more conservative farmhouses. And you can really look at the age of the house, because the main house at Whitney is actually late 1790s, early 1800s. Mm-hmm. So after you had, you know, a decade or maybe decade, 15 years or so of this money coming in, and there is a big distinction between, you know, those houses before sugarcane production really got up and revving and the ones that you see now. They were more modest, and you can immediately see that wealth with the construction of these homes.
It's an interesting, we're going to do a separate episode about visiting the plantation country, and we just thought this was a good segue and introduction to the area. But as you say that, the Whitney does feel like now obviously wealthy, but a farm, right? And then you go up the road, I think it's probably 30 miles to Nottoway. Mm-hmm. That's 53,000 square feet.
Yes, it's.
And that was, you know, that was many decades later, but by then that was an established economy, right? To your point.
Right.
One of the things that we touch on, I kind of like to visit a little bit, is we talked about, you know, slaves and the advantage to this human property being healthy. Well, the work of the plantation was hard work, and the process of creating granulated sugar, mm-hmm. if we could talk just a little bit about that, probably many people, including myself, growing up in New Orleans, you see the sugar kettles, and today sometimes they're used as fountains, which are quite beautiful. But there's a story there that is not so beautiful. And if we could just walk a little bit through, how did it come from harvesting sugarcane in the field to producing a product that was white gold?
Right. Well, first of all, too, there is the saying "being sold downriver." That specifically refers to enslaved people not wanting to be sold downriver to Louisiana and to work in the sugarcane fields. It was considered the most brutal of all of the work. So to your point, the sugarcane process itself, sugarcane is planted in March or so, mm-hmm. and then it's grown in November, it's harvested. So we just finished with harvesting the sugarcane around here. And when you come and visit Whitney, you'll see that there still are sugarcane fields that have been here for the last couple hundred years since sugarcane began. It's always been sugarcane fields. But anyway, during what we call grinding season in November, that cane, the green leafy part of the cane would be burned off first. So you had the burning of the sugarcane. Then you would have the stalks of sugarcane still in the fields. The enslaved people would come through with machetes, very mm-hmm. sharp machetes, and have to cut down that cane as quickly as possible. Because when it's still in the ground, it is rotting right there. So this has to be done very quickly, almost a 24-hour shift. So you had the enslaved people worked in chain gangs and in shifts. And so you had almost 24 hours of sugarcane production. And this was often done when there was poor to little light. So they're coming through with these sharp machetes, cutting down the sugarcane. Those were then placed in mule-drawn carriages and brought to the sugar mill at Whitney. Whitney had one sugar mill, and ground down. And after it was ground to a pulp, then that pulp was then transferred to one of those large sugar kettles that you were talking about. It was mixed with lime juice, and then the impurities would be burned off. So this is, and if you've seen the size, I'm not good with dimensions.
Gosh, the biggest one might be 8 feet across, yes. Something like that.
So it's huge, huge, over an open fire. And remember that this is sugar. And if you've ever made pralines before, you've ever boiled sugar and you've gotten some of that, you know, that boiling sugar on you, it's like the most painful burn that you can experience. So this is occurring over a set of four different pots. So four is referred to as a Jamaican train. So it's a Jamaican process for processing the sugar. But again, it took 60 to 70 men per set of pots in order to process this sugar. And it's huge, it's massive, over an open flame. So between the machetes in the field, poor lighting, having to, you know, literally slave over these pots, it was a very, very dangerous process.
Yeah, you're working over what seems obvious, I think, metal pots with boiling sugar in them. So, right, if you ever burned yourself with making candy or a roux, very similar.
Yes, yes.
And so you were walking around this pot with a big, it looks like a copper pot attached to a very long wooden handle.
Right, that's a good description.
And you're having to walk around this all the while, all the stress and everything happening, and move it and move it and move it, much like you would making candy today or a roux, but in the biggest pot you've ever seen.
Right.
And then having to move it as it cooks down into a smaller pot and a smaller pot and a smaller pot. Well, you're pouring this molten almost sugar mixture into these pots and handling these huge metal vats, maybe is a better word than pots. So the burns, the injuries, all of that stuff, not to mention you're exhausted.
Right. Well, and it has to happen very quickly. This is the time where the owner is going to make the most of the money. Everything depends on from grinding to the processing of the sugar. This is where the money is made. So it has to be done very quickly by any means necessary. So you can imagine what it would have been like, you know, during grinding season and processing for them, for the enslaved people to be under this kind of pressure to get the sugar processed.
Sure. You know, stress seems like the most, you know, the most understated word you could use here. But obviously there would have been accidents and there would have been pressure. And when mistakes happen, it certainly wasn't going to be the fault of the overseer or the plantation owner.
Right. Well, you know, you make a good point about it. This is obviously stressful and there's obviously a lot of pressure. But we have so many wonderful visitors, you know, of all different nationality of races that have embraced and want to know more about this story. But it almost seems like people don't think or don't believe that as enslaved people, that this was not stressful for them, that there was almost like, this is their role. This is their station in life. They didn't really understand what freedom was, you know, not in the same way that we understand freedom. So this idea of them having psychological stress, of them having pressure, of them having pathologies that developed and then also carried on into the African American, you know, community that we have now.
Sure.
Like, we almost have to go back and reinforce, like, yes, this was very stressful. You know, with the brutality, we have to use those common terms that, you know, is just obvious and natural to us to point out, like, yes, this was very stressful for them.
Well, and again, I think my visit here to the Whitney, it is about humanizing it.
Right.
Humanizing the experience and thinking about, if you have a job that you think is stressful today, and many of us have stressful jobs, now overlay it with all these things that we've just been talking about, right? And I think that that's what, it really helps set the tone and the context for coming to visit and learn about plantations. Both the opulence and the grandeur and all of that is a thing. That is, you know, but understanding how it was built. And I think on a bigger level, it helps frame the context of, again, trying to think about someone else's perspective.
Right.
Whether we're talking about slavery or we're talking about the challenges today, right? With politics and sexual harassment and so many other things.
Right. And, you know, and that's another good point that, you know, plantations, we all do we do things differently. And, you know, there is this fantasy associated with being on the plantation as an owner, especially as a woman on the plantation, and you're walking around maybe in the hoop skirts, which are not necessarily historically accurate. But there is, and you get on that porch and you are seduced by what it would have been like to be the woman of the house. And you have this, you know, beautiful alley of oaks in front of you and all of the grandeur, but no one like speaks to the experience of what it would have been like to be the mistress of the plantation, going back to the raping of women and, you know, the sexual exploitation that was going on. I mean, as a woman of the house, you know, there were, you had the knowledge that your husband, you know, was out there forcing himself on women and producing children, was being unfaithful to you. You know, so those are just certain things that are never really brought up and thought about when we're part of this like plantation mythology. But you know, it was a thing, and there would, as a mistress of a plantation, this is something that you would have to, you'd have to deal with.
Well, and that's a good segue to, if we can talk a bit about the ownership of the plantation and what happens. And I'm thinking particularly of Anna, and I'm jumping ahead a bit, but if we can just talk a little bit about the mistress of the house and how all that came to be.
Okay. So like I said earlier, 1752, when Ambrose Heidel originally started Whitney Plantation, it was Habitation Heidel at that point. And just to note, it was changed to Whitney Plantation after it was purchased in the 1860s by Bradish Johnson. And he named it after his daughter's new married name. So that's where Whitney Plantation came from. So excuse me if I go back and forth to referring to it as Habitation Heidel versus Whitney. But anyway, Habitation Heidel was passed along to Ambroise's grandsons, Jean-Jacques Heidel and Marceline Heidel. And the two of them ran a plantation together until 1839, when there was a falling out between the brothers, and Jean-Jacques ended up selling his share to Marceline Heidel. So Jean-Jacques and his wife and children move out of Habitation Heidel, and then it becomes Marceline's and his wife, Azalee Heidel, their property. That same year, though, Marceline dies, and then Azalee Heidel becomes the widow. She is the owner and operator of the plantation. They did not have children. And so Anna, a little enslaved girl, 10 or 11 years old, was purchased for Azalee as a companion. We believe that her mother, she was originally on a ship with her mother. Her mother died along the way. Her body was probably thrown overboard. And that's another thing that we don't think about as well, when what would happen to the sick and dying when the enslaved people were being transported. They were thrown overboard. And some people find that hard to believe and actually don't believe when we say this, but there are shark patterns that actually changed. They started following these big vessels because of the amount of people that were being thrown over when they were transported.
Well, and it comes back to where we started the conversation about, you have to get your mind around the fact that these were people, but they were property.
Yes.
So if you're moving property and there's some loss in the property, you cut your loss, right? You get rid of stuff. You see it today, sugarcane. Sugarcane flies off the top.
Absolutely.
Right? You keep moving. Well, it's the same, as harsh as that is. Mm. It was harsh.
It was harsh. And there, again, there were insurance policies.
So they were expecting some loss of product.
Absolutely.
The product, of course, being human beings. But loss of product as it made this journey across the ocean.
Right. It's just, daily course of doing business. So anyway, back to Anna. She was purchased for Azalee, and Azalee keeps her in the house as a companion. And it's not too long after that, Azalee's brother comes in and visits her, and Anna shortly thereafter becomes pregnant. And at first she did not want to tell Azalee who the father was, but she finally reveals that she was raped by Azalee's brother. So Azalee makes sure that the baby is taken to St. John the Baptist Church, which is about 10, 15 miles downriver from us. It's a very, very old, church. And so she ensures that this baby is baptized as a Heidel. And that baby is Victor Heidel, which is a very important lineage for Louisiana and especially New Orleans, because one of Victor's descendants is Sybil Heidel, who marries Ernest Morial. So Sybil Heidel Morial. And of course, Ernest, or Dutch Morial, was the first African-American mayor of New Orleans. And then their son, Mark Morial, was the third African-American mayor of New Orleans and is also president of the National Urban League. So that's where their ancestors were here at Whitney Plantation and from Wallace, Louisiana.
And when you shared that with me the other day, it also brought forward that we sometimes talk about in the public narrative that slavery was so long ago.
Right.
And yet you see, for New Orleanians, every New Orleanian of a certain age, as you were telling that story, is going, oh yeah, I remember. I was a kid when Dutch Morial was mayor, and it wasn't that long ago that Mark Morial was mayor.
Right.
And so it really sort of brings it home through today.
Right.
And I think that as we were talking about it, it also, you see the, you were telling us that Whitney, while it certainly wasn't, there weren't slaves here, it was an active plantation and people were living here until the 1970s,
I think. Until the 1970s, yes. And we tend to forget that after slavery, when there was emancipation, now you're dealing with a labor force that is most likely illiterate. And even Victor Heidel, even though he was a Heidel, he was still listed as an enslaved person on the records until emancipation. And he could not read or write. You know, so so after you have this labor population and they're all freed, what are they going to do? You know, and where can they go to find work? Where can they go to find housing? They had nowhere. So they would end up right back on the plantation in those same cabins. And then generations after generations after generations, up until the 1970s, almost the 80s, their families were still living in the cabins here at Whitney and at other on other plantations along the river.
Well, and you do see it as you go up and down River Road. We were recently at nearby Ocala, and when you look at some of the history that they have, so sure, slaves were freed, air quotes, after the Civil War, but then many of them stayed right on those same plantations.
Absolutely.
And were technically freedmen, but they were under contract, and often they were paid in tokens.
Yes.
Or, you know, we're going to pay you, but you can either re-up at the end,
right,
and presumably you haven't gotten any money, mm-hmm, or you can use that money or token or credit at the company store.
Right.
Well, who owns a company store?
Right, the plantation
does. And so you do see, it's not that far a stretch to see that legacy. Even driving up and down River Road, you can see old shacks and, mm-hmm, abandoned shacks and some not abandoned.
Right.
And that legacy isn't so very long ago when you think about that.
No, and we, Whitney also had a plantation store, and we're working on a project right now. We're going in a community and taking oral narratives from people that were here at Whitney after emancipation, because that's part of the story that's not really is not addressed, what it would have been like as an enslaved person. I mean, I'm sorry, as a free person still working in this plantation economy and a division of labor. And obviously you don't have an overseer, but now you have a manager, and just the different ways they were treated and the ways that they were paid or not paid, and dynamics is also very interesting.
Sure. And again, that's one of the things, just driving up River Road, you do sort of, as you take it in, It comes home in a very real way. Mm-hmm. One of the things I did mention, obviously, we're visiting with Joey Banner at the Whitney Plantation, and I'll put all the links to how you can find out about the Whitney and some resources over at beyondbourbonst.com. And how did we find, I should have checked this with you, the Whitney Plantation, is it whitneyplantation.com?
Yes, whitneyplantation.com.
And again, we'll link all of that. You guys have in the bookshop, and we'll put some references as well. Lots of great books that kind of help trace, you know, there are recountings of people who were enslaved. Mm-hmm. Dr. Seck, who's done much of the research here along with you guys, has written a book about some of the people that you guys have been able to document that, yes, lived and were enslaved here at the plantation.
Yes, and the title of the book is Bukife Gambo, that's available on our website as well. But it's a really good, when you come to the tour here, it's a lot of information, and obviously we can't hit every single thing, but the book definitely will allow you to get more of the specific details. You don't have to remember everything. You can just refer back to the book, so I highly recommend it.
Well, and again, the point for me as the host of Beyond Bourbon Street and starting, we wanted to do a couple episodes about plantations. We know that people like to visit the plantations and see them. And to me, it's important to start here and understand The plantations, and we'll talk about in a different episode, many of them cover slavery. They address it or they don't address it in different ways. And each place is different, has a perspective. But for me to enter into sort of this journey up the Mississippi along River Road, it's really a really great resource here at the Whitney to be able to stop and think about the things that we're talking about today and kind of set your perspective as you then go and visit other places. It's certainly the way that I've chosen to do this is I hadn't been to a plantation since I was a little kid. And this whole path of wanting to share it with you, the listeners, I really thought about what's the narrative and how do you present it. And I think the resources that you all have created here at the Whitney are really special and help frame that experience, if you will. And I know, you know, we've only sort of touched on, there's many exhibits and things that you can see to really immerse yourself here. And again, try to get that perspective of these people that lived and told, you know, lived and had stories and had lives and died here, and what that might mean through today's lens.
Well, and also too, yes, Whitney Plantation had slavery specifically here at this site. But even if those plantation homes don't exist anymore, or you're from an area where there wasn't a large concentration of plantation homes, slavery at some point most likely existed in your area, or your area was impacted by the economy of slavery. And so what I want people, and I encourage people to visit these plantations and Whitney to learn about the enslaved people, we need to understand that this was just something that's universal across the country, but, you know, across the world as well. So I think everyone should look at specifically do some research in your area and see how your economy in your community was affected by it, how you were, you know, and to do some research into it, because it's not good enough to have, we're one window, we're one touch point of slavery, we're one tool to teach about, you know, slavery, but it's definitely something that is so pervasive that I think we all need to do our homework and our research and find out more about slavery and its impact.
Well, and it's a great point, and slavery exists throughout the world today.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And so as Americans, we tend to focus on the South in this period of time, mm-hmm. But you make a great point. And this is a subject for another day. But the other thing that really hit me wandering around here the other day with you is that in Louisiana, we have these private prisons.
Yes.
And the per capita rate of incarceration, particularly of African-American males in New Orleans and in Louisiana, is way, way higher than the average. And in a sense, it's not very far removed from slavery. So we need a population to do the work of the plantations, mm-hmm. of the prisons. Those are private prisons. There's a for-profit motive there.
Right.
And again, I only bring it up to say that I think your point's so important. If you're thinking, well, this is not my neck of the woods, my part of the world, mm-hmm. it's not a very big stretch to find where that does relate, wherever you are in the world.
Well, and people are usually surprised, and I was surprised when I found this fact out, which was not very long ago, I'll admit, that New York considered seceding from the Union during the Civil War because there was so much of the economy, so many goods that were going into New York. You know, so this is not a Southern thing. You know, it affected all parts of the country. So we have to just be aware that even if you weren't in the South, or even if, and I point this out, Donna Cummings, who's married to John Cummings, the founder, she always states that her family's originally from Italy. I think she is either second or third generation, so very, in a sense, new to the country. And initially she thought, well, you know, my family wasn't involved in slavery. You know, so it was like, well, you know, we kind of have clean hands when it comes to slavery. But then, you know, as she's doing more research here and as she thought about it, she realized that the reason why my family wanted to come to the United States is to have that American dream. And that American dream was closely tied to slavery. You know, so it's like she understood that there was a privilege to her and her family, you know, being able to come here. And that was still on the backs of slavery.
Sure. Well, again, we're here at the Whitney Plantation. And I think it's a, you know, sort of an unusual path that led to the creation of the Whitney in its modern form. You think, again, this man, John Cummings in New Orleans, who decides to buy a plantation. And here we are having this discussion. I want to thank you so much, Joy, for taking the time to share the story with us.
My pleasure. And thank you for visiting and allowing us to share this mission. You know, it's something that is very close to my heart, you know, being a descendant from this plantation and from, you know, other plantations along the River Road. And, you know, it's all about, yes, getting that story out, but also, you know, us helping the community. We are in a community of people that are descended, you know, from the enslaved population. And, you know, my dream, my personal mission is for us to take whatever success that we have and translate that into opportunity and education for our community and for any community, really.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm so thankful to Joy for welcoming my wife and I to the Whitney and talking about the topic of slavery with us. We actually visited the Whitney on the first morning of our trip, but decided not to do the interview until we visited several other plantations. And I'm glad we did it that way. We needed time to reflect on what we had seen and heard at Whitney. Plus, visiting some of the others helped influence a narrative that I thought was important to explore with Joy. This is a tough topic, and I'm certain there'll be reactions to this episode, unlike any of the others I've done. I hope what you gain from listening is a deeper understanding and appreciation for enslaved people. Not only the ones brought to Louisiana and to the plantations here, but maybe also the enslaved around the world today. I do think a visit to the Whitney is an excellent way to explore the plantations along River Road. It helps set the context for what you see at many of the others. And again, we'll cover the ins and outs of a trip to visit the plantations in a future episode. We'll talk about the grandeur and the innovations, as well as logistics, including where to stay, visit, eat, all that stuff. We'll talk about how to see plantations if you only have a day, and what to do if you have a couple nights to explore like we did. You can find the notes for today's episode over at beyondbourbonst.com/54, including links to the Whitney's website at whitneyplantation.com. If you want to hear more shows like this one, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. Coming up next time will be part two of our exploration into River Road and plantation country. And if you're enjoying the show, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you and me. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.